This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Politics seem to be consuming our lives, whether we like it or not. We're all caught up in a 24/7 news cycle in which politics dominates. So today, we revisit some stories making political news, from tomorrow's local elections to the Virginia governor's race that may be a referendum on Donald Trump, to the redrawing of legislative districts in our state. And then there's the new GOP tax plan and Robert Mueller's ongoing investigation into Russian interference in the last presidential election. We're joined by Dr. Eric Heberleg, Associate Professor of Political Science at UNC Charlotte. Welcome back.
Thanks, Mike.
Dr. Michael Bitzer is Provost at and Professor of Politics and History at Catawba College. Welcome to you.
Good to be here.
And for the first time, we welcome Loretta Boniti, Raleigh-based senior political reporter for Spectrum News and host of that network's public affairs program, In Focus. Loretta, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, search for WFAE on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. So am I right? Do we seem to be living in this never-ending political conversation all the time, every day?
Sure. Yeah.
Is that abnormal? Is it recent? Is this normal? That's my question. Is it normal?
I mean, politics certainly dominates our society and our lives, but I think it has taken on a whole new intensity just because of the willingness of our chief executive, the president, to really engage in ways that previous presidents haven't and really make known his thoughts on major, minor, inconsequential issues, and everybody has a discussion around it.
So that was going to be my next question. Is this media-driven, is it issue-driven, or is it personality-driven, meaning by the president?
Well, certainly Donald Trump has had an effect on it, but the social media environment just speeds things up tremendously. Yeah. And the wider media environment of 24-hour cable where they need content.
Right.
So you look for things on social media to fill up that airspace. And Trump leveraged that dynamic incredibly well during his campaign to not spend money buying advertisements the way candidates traditionally run, but to use his social media statements as a way of drawing free media coverage.
And I know, Loretta, you talk about politics every day on Spectrum News, and that's a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week network situation with news. But we don't hear about state politics all that as much as we do about national politics. And we're going to talk about this local election in Charlotte tomorrow. These local elections, these state elections, affect people more, it could be argued, than the national elections. And yet we're not consumed at this level, are we, in your opinion?
No, we're really not. And I often like to point that out to people when I have direct conversations with them, that yes, what's going on at the national level, it makes a difference. We need to know what policies are getting passed by Congress or that the president is pushing for. But really, it makes a difference what your local politics are. Those are the things that are going to affect you most directly. You know, what your property tax bill is going to look like, what's going on in your city and county. And no, folks just don't pay as much attention to that, but those are probably the races that they should be paying the most attention to.
Since that's what you cover, do you knock your head against the wall wondering why people aren't paying more attention?
Yes. I mean, as far as state politics, I mean, we've obviously had some of these stories in the news. We all know state politics has also been getting a decent amount of coverage, but it's getting a decent amount of coverage for these sensational stories,
right,
that you know, it's two or three stories, but there's a lot of policy that's coming out on the state level that people should be paying attention to, and they don't. And no matter how many times you repeat it to them, they're still not paying attention.
What's the one story that sticks out in your head as one we ought to be paying attention to, but we're not?
I don't know if I feel like people pay enough attention to what actually is going on as far as tax policy in the state, decisions that are being made with that, and how the ripple effect of what is happening with tax policy, be it the good things that, you know, we are seeing an improved economy and all of those things, or the bad things that we don't have the money to necessarily pay for some programs,
right,
that, you know, the state traditionally has paid for.
So, of course, this – go ahead, Michael.
I was just going to say, you know, whenever I talk to students, I say, you know, all the interest is at the national level, the president, you know, the Congress, whatnot. And I say, when would you have the opportunity to meet someone who can make those kinds of decisions and impact your daily life in the produce section of Harris Teeter or Food Lion. I once had a city council member for the city of Salisbury say, I was accosted next to the asparagus by an outraged constituent. And that kind of interaction, that kind of influence
right.
is, you know, local government affects you on a day-to-day basis.
Right.
And you may have the opportunity to interact with a mayor, city council member, school board member. And those are things that people just kind of shove off and say, you know what, I'm really not interested in that.
Well, let's talk about local government and something people aren't interested in. That is the mayoral election here in Charlotte. It's tomorrow. Everybody knows this. Early voting's been going on, and I went and early voted last week. And one of the poll workers there told me last Saturday when we first opened, 24 people voted all day. 24. So we're going to get a new mayor, no matter what happens in this election. We're going to get new members of city council and of school board, not to mention a decision on the school bonds that are the most expensive school bonds this system has ever asked for, $922 million, almost $1 billion. A Spectrum News poll last month found that the race for mayor between Democrat Vi Lyles and Republican Kendi Smith is practically tied. This is a predominantly Democratic city. Does the closeness of this race surprise you, Dr. Heberle?
Yes and no. The three out of the four last mayoral races, the last three that have been open seats, have been very close. They've been – the winner has had like 52-53% of the vote. So what was surprising about that poll was that it was close even without counting the turnout, which can be very different in these local races. So in the poll, you have it basically tied even though – you have a lot of Democrats, presumably, who are selecting the Democratic candidate in the poll who actually aren't going to turn out to vote.
Why not?
Why not? Because Democratic constituencies skew younger, tend to be more minority, tend to be lower income, all demographic groups of people who just turn out less regularly.
But those are the very people that would benefit from a voice.
Presumably. Sure. But sure. It's well known in the United States, generation after generation, that turnout skews towards higher-income people.
When you combine that with the fact that a lot of people say that people vote against their own economic self-interest in national elections because of ideology, is that fueling the anger, perhaps, that we're seeing in the country, that people are not getting what they want, but they keep voting for people who are not going to give them what they want?
Certainly that's part of it. They feel unrepresented, but often don't turn out to vote at all, and are choosing people who are good at identifying grievances, but not people who are good at solving problems.
You were quoted in yesterday's paper, Eric, as saying that fallout from HB2 and the Keith Lamont Scott shooting are still there and probably work to the Republicans' advantage. Which of those issues do you think is having the greater impact?
Probably the Keith Lamont Scott shooting.
Why?
Because it affects both the African American and the Caucasian communities, but in different ways. That you have the African American community demanding that something be done, both in terms of dealing with police brutality and in terms of dealing with economic inequality. But moving on either of those issues makes the white voters think, oh, they're coming after my wallet, or they're going after police and making things less safe, plus the fact that just the fact that the riots happened create a lot of uncertainty that this is not Charlotte and we don't know what to do with that, so things aren't really going the way we want them to.
So if you agree that that's the issue that seems to be the predominant issue fueling this, is it actually really fueling the Republican side of things because they saw the riots, didn't like it, that's not Charlotte, that's not what we do? And it was a Democratic mayor who they saw as inflaming this or not siding with the police.
I think all of that is there. The flip side that I would look at are just the basic numbers. And in this city, it is almost 50% registered Democrats. They will be the plurality of voters who show up. And I think there's something to be said for partisan loyalty. It doesn't matter what election it is. We're generally tending to see if you identify as a Democrat or a Republican, you're going to vote for that party no matter what. I think, you know, the past two elections have been competitive, but if you dig down into the precinct level, only 8 out of 170 precincts were competitive. The others were 55% or more for one candidate over the other. So I think that's going to play in a dynamic that really we can't know until, you know, is it going to be 17% voter turnout? Is it going to be 20%? Is it going to be 15? It's
so the Spectrum News poll sees a 40-40 split. Loretta, do you have any idea how that poll was taken since it was your organization that did it?
Well, it was conducted by Survey USA, so you know, the split of who they actually called for this poll as far as potential voters and folks who were expected to vote, we did seem to skew towards a high number of unaffiliated voters in the poll, perhaps a little bit higher percentage than we actually have of it should have been a little more with some Democratic voters. Mm-hmm. But I think that is probably a fair representation of who could be showing up at the polls. We really don't know how many people will show up to vote. You heard those numbers that Dr. Bitzer just said. We're not expecting a huge turnout in this race. So if you're only getting 1 out of every 5 voters, the fact is a lot of them are going to be these unaffiliated voters. So how they skew in this race, and if they're skewing a little bit more toward Kenny Smith, then it could be a tight race tomorrow.
And, of course, the question I always have, and maybe you can answer this definitively, I don't know, about unaffiliated voters in North Carolina is, are they unaffiliated because they simply don't identify with one political party or the other, or are they unaffiliated because they really are Democrats or Republicans who want the opportunity to vote in the opposite primary?
I think it definitely skews younger. So when you're talking about Gen Xers, but in particularly millennials, the numbers that I've looked at in terms of the registered unaffiliated in the state is heavily younger voters, those voters under the age of 35. I think, though, that sometimes that could be the cover, and yet they are still partisan when they show up to vote. So if you self-identify as an independent or unaffiliated, but you get asked, well, do you lean to one party or do you lean to the other? If you lean to one party over the other, you're going to vote for that party just as much as partisans do.
So in this 40-40 split that Spectrum News uncovered, Lyles is leading with women. Smith is leading with men. Black voters back Lyles 2-1, while white voters support Kenny Smith 2-1. Voter turnout is predicted to be 17%. We'll see if that holds. So what does that tell you about our electorate? Is that normal to be split? Women are going to vote for her. Men are going to vote for him. Black people are going to vote for her because she's African-American. White people are going to vote for him because he's white. What does that tell you?
Well, no, it tells me that Democrats are going to vote for the Democratic candidate and Republicans are going to vote for the Republican candidate. And those
Why?
Demographics...
How do you get there from those figures? Are all white people Republican?
No, certainly not all. But we have racial divisions, we have gender divisions, we have socioeconomic class divisions that line up more evenly now than ever before in terms of our partisan identification.
Okay. And what role do you think turnout will play? Is low turnout?
It'll be huge.
Huge.
That'll make
Absolutely.
The difference.
And we'll talk about why in a second. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more with Dr. Eric Heberling from UNC Charlotte, Dr. Michael Bitzer from Catawba College, and Loretta Beniti from Spectrum News, the host of In Focus on that network. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Greer Walker, a certified public accounting firm with a team of more than 100 professionals providing assurance, tax, and business advisory services to middle market companies in the Carolinas. Details at greerwalker.com. And Bricks, wood-fired pizza, inviting community organizations across Charlotte to contact their neighborhood Bricks location to schedule a Bricks Bucks fundraising event. Details available at brickspizza.com. Well, a look at voter participation in Charlotte's local elections on this program tomorrow. Over the past decade, turnout has declined in mayoral elections. Last time Pat McCrory ran for mayor, 24% of voters turned out in his final term. Less than 15% came out 2 years ago, and officials predict 17% turnout tomorrow compared to the 66% turnout of recent presidential elections. So why do so few people vote in elections that affect them most? We talk about that tomorrow at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the GOP tax plan, the rich and the middle class. We tote up the numbers and look at the impact from all angles. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point, coming up right after Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon, here on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Dr. Eric Heberleg from UNC Charlotte, Dr. Michael Bitzer with Catawba College political scientists. Both Loretta Beniti is a senior political reporter, not a scientist, and she doesn't play one on television, but she does host In Focus on Spectrum News. Let's talk about voter turnout. It's predicted to be low tomorrow or today and throughout early voting because it's an off-year election on Friday. 50% of early voters were Democrats. Michael Bitzer tells us 25.5% were Republicans. I'm not sure how we know that. The rest were unaffiliated, but you can tell us.
I can tell you exactly. The State Board of Elections collects all the data of folks who show up, and every night at 5 a.m. they dump the data, and you can actually look and see who has cast ballots by their party affiliation, by age, by location.
Or you could ask the Russians.
I wasn't going to go there, but sure.
And the rest were unaffiliated.
Yes.
So what you just before the break, Eric, you said that low voter turnout is going to play a major role in the outcome of this election. How so?
Well, because when you have low turnout, the margins can be, you know, a couple of thousand votes is going to determine the outcome, particularly in this city council seats.
Who does that favor?
Well, the side that gets its voters out. So the fact that the Democrats have more registered voters here gives them the advantage going into it. If they turn out roughly in proportion of their share of total voters, they win. The Republicans have to overperform. They have to get more voters to turn out compared to their share of the total electorate. But as I was also saying earlier, Republican voters tend to be more regular voters. The Democratic voters, because of their demographic characteristics, are good at showing up in presidential elections, but not in any other election. So that's why Charlotte mayoral elections have been very close over the last decade, despite the Democrats' dominance in registration numbers.
So if Democrats turn out, they win.
They win, yes.
Yeah, just by sheer numbers.
So if practice – I'm going to change topics here because we'll have to wait till tomorrow to see what actually happens in our election tomorrow. Loretta, if practice makes perfect, that doesn't seem to be true when it comes to drawing legislative maps. We've had a lot of practice that. And most recently, a federal court has decided to hire an outside expert to redraw 2 Senate and 7 House districts that have been previously ruled tainted by racial bias. How unusual is it for a court to turn to outside help?
It's certainly the last resort in this case. I mean, keep in mind, these are the maps that were drawn in 2011, and we're now in 2017, and this is how long it took us to get to the point where we're hiring somebody from outside of the legislature to redraw districts for the court for these maps. And you know, Republicans they put in a protest to this. They don't believe that somebody who's outside of the legislature should be drawing the maps. They believe that this is their responsibility to do it. The court said, "That's nice that you think that, but we've given you a chance, and this is how it's going to be handled now." I think the long and short of this is that even though we have somebody from the outside drawing these maps, that the court is deeming to be a fair and unbiased person doing it, that does not mean that by any means we're done with lawsuits associated with this. Because if these maps come out and Republicans or Democrats don't like them, we'll see a whole other round of lawsuits on whatever these new maps are.
Well, the court hired Stanford University law professor Nathaniel Persily to redo these maps by December 1st, so we will know in less than a month what these maps will look like. And Democrats, of course, reacted favorably to that decision. Republicans, on the other hand, questioned Dr. Persily's impartiality. Is that worry justified because of past performance? Because he's done this a lot, evidently.
I don't know about it. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I mean, yeah, sure. There's you're always going to be able to point to something that somebody has said or somebody has done that you're going to be able to say, see, that's why this person isn't fair if you don't like that. But I don't think that any of that matters. Everybody is looking to see what the exact balance is going to be to Republicans to Democrats. And ultimately, that is what people care about coming out of it.
Eric?
Yeah, I don't know about his work on redistricting, but I know of his work on other election-related. Mm-hmm. You know, and he's a solid scholar. You know, you might distrust him because he's a college professor, and that might be well warranted. But, you know, courts have increasingly turned to outside people to draw lines because legislatures have just become so partisan in how they do it. And the technology has made it so easy to skew the lines in the favor of one side or the other that it's unfortunate we've come to this place. But, you know, it's been 7 years, and it'd be good to have district lines that actually allow voters to choose who they want to represent them rather than politicians choosing their voters.
Is the court likely to accept these districts the way he draws them?
I think so.
I would think so.
Is the legislature likely to sit back or no, the legislature will continue this fight?
I mean, to be fair, Republicans brought in their own outside consultant to draw the original maps, and he was able to use it in a very fine-tooth approach to drawing these maps that have basically bought Republicans an insurance policy and dominating the legislature.
So the three of you have been following this probably a lot more closely than I have. But let me give a little digest here of how we got to this point, if I'm right. Correct me if I'm wrong. These districts were first ordered redrawn by the legislature based on rules that prohibited the use of the racial data of voters. But judges said that this redraw did not fix all of the problems and questioned how using political data and protecting incumbents within favorable boundaries perpetuated the impermissible use of race, which had been rendered unconstitutional in 2011. My head is about to explode. But the court told Professor Persily that he can review racial data to ensure there would be no unconstitutional racial gerrymandering. So, could all of this have been avoided had GOP legislators been able to use racial data to draw these districts?
They originally did use it because they believe they needed to set a criteria that the court later found was impermissible. So the use of race has been influenced throughout this entire process. The question is, how much can you use it and how much can't you use it? And you have to then tie in the fact that racial politics is partisan politics, particularly in the South. You're going to have black voters voting overwhelmingly Democratic. White voters tend by majority numbers to vote for Republicans. So it's all kind of spaghettified into a mess that we're still trying to figure out where the balance is.
Well, and the other challenge for the legislature has been that the courts have changed the rules as we've gone on, that we'll give them credit for trying to meet the rules as they were in 2010 when they first drew the district lines. And then the courts have sort of moved the goalpost on them as we've gone through this revision process.
So, and we know that racial gerrymandering is unconstitutional now. Political gerrymandering is still quite legal, but it may not be long for the world if this case in Wisconsin goes through. Does that mean if they decide these maps work, that the Wisconsin court decision comes down and suddenly they won't work? They'll have to be redrawn yet again because of that?
Welcome to redistricting.
Okay. All right. We don't normally talk about Virginia very much on this program, but the race for governor in the Old Dominion has lots of people watching to see whether former Republican National Committee Chairman Ed Gillespie's race against that state's Democratic Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam will end up being tied to President Trump. It is said, and it was said just moments ago on NPR this morning, that Virginia's gubernatorial election has traditionally been an early bellwether for new presidents. Who wants to take that? Why is that so?
Really, there's only two governor's races that occur in an off-year election, the year right after, New Jersey and Virginia. And New Jersey's more of a solidly Democratic state, where Virginia's a swing state. Mm-hmm. So people's reaction to the current president, it's really the first chance to see who's turning out, what issues they're reacting to, whether the gubernatorial candidates try to pull in those national events and influences to try to mobilize their sides on them.
Plus, I heard this morning that Virginia tends to elect governors of the opposite party of the president. We have a Democratic governor there now, right?
Right.
Why is that?
Well, in Virginia, politics is always been a swing state that it could go either way. But when you start to look at the statewide races in Virginia right now, it's starting more and more to tend to lean towards Democrat. So whereas you always saw the governors being opposite of the presidential candidate, Northern Virginia is by far the huge population base of the state. They call it Nova there, and they call the rest of the state Rova, the rest of Virginia. So the fact that Northern Virginia is getting more and more populated and it's very heavily Democratic, that means statewide races are more and more going to lean towards the Democratic Party.
I grew up in Northern Virginia, and Northern Virginia has the same complex that Mecklenburg County has. It's Northern Virginia, which ought to be running the show, mm-hmm. but everybody else hates Northern Virginia.
Right. It's the dynamics of urbanism versus everybody else.
In that race, Gillespie, the Republican, has taken a Trumpian stand against illegal immigrant gangs and a Latino group supporting the Democratic lieutenant governor, ran an ad showing scared minority children being chased by a truck with a Gillespie for Governor sticker on the back of it. The ad was pulled, but experts say that if this race was not already a referendum on Trump, that ad made it so. Really? Can one ad do that? Really?
Well,
it's when we saw the numbers start to change in Virginia. Was after that ad ran. Gillespie was down quite a bit in the polls, and he certainly made up quite a bit of ground after that ad ran, and it did not run for very long. But it changed the conversation in Virginia for sure.
Hmm.
Well, and part of that was the other Republican candidate in the primary basically ran on one issue, which was the, preventing the tearing down of Confederate statues.
Mm-hmm.
And you had this Trump faction of the party versus the establishment faction of the party, which Gillespie represents. He's a former head of the Republican National Committee, longtime lobbyist. So what Gillespie has done is use those anti-immigration ads, anti-crime ads, as a way of trying to appeal to the Trump faction of the party and mobilize them to turn out to vote.
Because evidently he's not talking about Donald Trump at all, and Trump is also not campaigning for him in Virginia. It seems to be unusual. Is that because he's been asked not to campaign or because he doesn't want to get burned like he was, I believe, in Alabama, campaigning for the loser?
Yeah, there could be that, but I think this is a kind of a test, I would say, of does the Trump politics still work without Trump necessarily being in the race? And he's certainly a major factor.
Wouldn't you say yes, it does?
We'll see.
If people are really that angry and they were attracted to Donald Trump because he spoke their language, whether you have the president saying these things or somebody else.
Or Ed Gillespie. It could be.
Just as President Trump and congressional GOP members have put forth a new federal income tax plan, Ed Gillespie is promoting one. He's the Republican, as we've been talking about, Republican candidate for governor of Virginia. And his plan would cut income taxes there by 10% across the board and eliminate several local taxes that he says harms business. Democratic Lieutenant Governor Northam has said nothing about his tax plan. Will this combination of possible federal and state tax cuts resonate with Virginia voters?
That sounds like a normal campaign to me. Republicans
really
promised to cut taxes. Democrats tried to avoid the subject.
And this race evidently had some wild swings in pre-election polls, as did the previous presidential election. Wild swings in the polls. Can polls be used anymore as a predictor of what's going to happen on Election Day? Do people tell the truth to pollsters? Are pollsters reaching people who need to be reached? Because it's becoming increasingly difficult to get people on their landline, telephones, et cetera. Can we trust them?
It's always been hard to use polls to predict turnout because people give you the socially desirable answer when you ask them, are you going to turn out to vote? They say yes, even when they're not going to. So the challenge isn't that the polls are really wrong or necessarily even that they're polling the wrong people. It's just that people who turn out on election day are different than the people who are answering the polls. So the challenge always is for pollsters is trying to weed out the people who aren't really going to turn out, but then they're basing those predictions on the type of demographics of people who turned out in the last election, which may not be the same as people who are going to turn out in this election.
So if the Virginia governor's race is a bellwether and a predictor on how the mood of the country is after 11 months of a Donald Trump presidency, what will it mean if Republicans win? What will it mean if the Democrats win?
I think for Republicans, it will be a reaffirmation of the Trump philosophy that they think they can carry forward into next year's very challenging midterm elections. I think for Democrats, it's only going to antagonize the divisions within the party. I mean, this past week, you saw the former interim DNC chair come out and blast the Clinton campaign. Now there's questions about, you know, was it really what Donna Brazile was talking about as factually true and and true to the party. I think, you know, a lot of people are still fighting last year's election.
Before last year's election, everybody said the Republican Party was broken and that they would spend years in the wilderness because of the campaign, and yet they won. And now it's the Democratic Party that's broken, and they're spending they're doing a lot of navel gazing to try to figure out how to fuse things back together. Yeah. How did we miss that? The media and pundits and political scientists got that completely wrong.
No, I think Obama was what held the Democrats together. And as soon as Obama was off the scene, the fissures that were there in the Democratic Party and were held together because of loyalty to a Democratic president would be seen. And what makes it worse, of course, is losing to a candidate like Donald Trump, who Democrats felt was obvious that any Democrat should be able to beat. And I think if Northam, the Democratic candidate, loses in Virginia, it's really going to make these Democratic divisions worse, because here you have a candidate who's a moderate, who's establishment, who campaigns in rural areas, who's inoffensive. If he loses, you know, the Democrats have to do some serious regrouping and thinking about what type of message they give to voters, because they're in deep doo-doo.
And Northam is the kind of classic Virginia Democrat who should be able to win. I mean, he's kind of a Mark Warner kind of style of a Democrat. And, you know, the Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party is going to scream for more progressive, more liberal approaches. And, you know, that's just not going to play in a southern state like Virginia, like North Carolina.
And both of those candidates Virginia have been described as being bland. I don't know whether that plays to their favor or not. But Virginia went for Barack Obama, I believe, twice, and Hillary Clinton in the last election. If they don't go for the Democratic candidate here, what does that say?
I think it's going to be a lot of soul searching within the Democratic Party as to how they position themselves for next year.
We have a lot more to talk about with regard to politics that seems to be surrounding us, including the GOP tax bill, the Robert Mueller investigation into Russia, and some Donald Trump tweets, if we have time to get to them before the program is over. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and SunTrust Bank, providing private wealth management teams of local advisors to help navigate the life clients have built and help prepare for whatever life brings. Confidence starts here. More info at suntrust.com/reserve. And Duke Energy, committed to building a smarter energy future for the Carolinas. More details at duke-energy.com/future. Coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on Point, Tom Ashbrook and his guests will talk about the shooting rampage in Texas that claimed 26 lives near San Antonio yesterday. And they'll also talk about the big GOP tax plan that's been proposed on Capitol Hill. On Point, 20 minutes right now here on WFAE. We will continue to talk about politics and how it's, I guess, permeated everything in our culture of late when we come back. Stay with us.
Wherever the day's biggest story is unfolding, Morning Edition will connect you to the voices at the center of it all.
Police say a man in a rented Home Depot truck
drove... The indictment alleges that Manafort and Gates used...
This comes after the Catalan parliament declared independence. Whether the news hits close to home or whether it's actually happening close to home. Start your day with Morning Edition tomorrow.
Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Loretta Beniti is with us for the first time, political reporter, senior political reporter for Spectrum News and the host of that network's In Focus program, which is, I believe, seen on Sundays, if I'm not mistaken. Dr. Eric Heberling is here, professor of political science at UNC Charlotte. Dr. Michael Bitzer, provost of and political science professor at Catawba College. Let's move on to the Robert Mueller investigation. Special counsel Mueller looking into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. He recently charged three of President Trump's campaign associates, one-time campaign chairman Paul Manafort and Rick Gates, another campaign worker, indicted on 12 counts, including money laundering and working as unregistered foreign agents. While George Papadopoulos, somebody most of us had never heard of before, including evidently the president, a low-level foreign policy advisor who came to Trump's campaign from the Ben Carson campaign, pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI. Of course, there are immediate comparisons to Watergate. Is this Watergate 2.0?
Not yet. No.
Is this how Watergate 1.0 started?
No.
Okay.
There are really three different types of things that Special Prosecutor Mueller is investigating. And we saw in the indictments this week two of those tracks appear. One is private financial dealings, which Paul Manafort and Gates were charged with. And there's the potential there if Mueller investigates Trump's private finances and his business dealings in Russia, that there might be something there, such as taxes.
Can we assume he's doing that right now?
I would think so.
Does he have access to the income tax returns that the president has so far refused to release?
I bet he can get them. The second tract is the collusion, potential collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians. And here your Watergate analogy might work in that they're starting with the low-level people and charging them, getting them to cooperate and give potential testimony against higher-ups, and we'll see how far we get. The third approach is on the obstruction of justice. Did Trump's firing of FBI Director Comey, was that intended to interfere with the Russia investigation? In terms of legal jeopardy, any of those could be legal jeopardy to Trump. In terms of impeachment issues, that's less in terms of narrow criminality, more in terms of violation of separation of powers. Yeah. The obstruction of justice is more the danger to Trump.
And Robert Mueller has a wide berth to investigate whatever comes his way, whatever he uncovers. He can go in that direction or the other direction. Well, there's also a House and Senate committee investigation into Russian interference in our election. And Richard Burr, North Carolina's Richard Burr, is heading up the Senate investigation. Loretta, a lot of people, particularly the president, have called this a witch hunt. Is that what Richard Burr thinks about it?
No, he doesn't think that it is at this point. Richard Burr is, as expected, rather tight-lipped about where he thinks that this is all going to end up. However, he did say that with these indictments that have come down and information that has come out from the Mueller investigation, that they can actually use that in the investigation that he is doing. And I think the long and short of this is that, yes, the president would like this to all go away and feels like that this investigation has been going on for long enough. I think anybody involved in any of these investigations really doesn't think that we're anywhere near the end of these investigations. There's just still a lot to go.
And South Carolina's Lindsey Graham has said several times that if the president tries to interfere in these investigations, either telling his attorney general to do something or firing the special prosecutor, that there'd be hell to pay, essentially. Mueller has charged these three people that he's brought to the forefront with serious crimes, some of which can have significant jail time attached to that if they are ultimately convicted. And that's led to speculation that the president may, in fact, simply pardon these people before any trial takes place. So that would negate whatever leverage Robert Mueller might have over them to come forward and spill their guts. What would be the political ramifications for President Trump of a pardon issued prior to the end of the investigation or prior to a trial?
Well, we've seen the president willing to pardon Joe Arpaio out in Arizona. So there is a
But that was
precedent.
After.
That was after the trial, but before the sentencing.
Right.
I'm scared to say what the political ramifications would be. I think it would be intense. I think the backlash would be severe. The question is, will Republicans buck their president? When Nixon was impeached by the House, there were numerous Republicans that voted not to impeach the president. And I think
it was a Democratic-controlled House.
It was a Democratic-controlled House, and it ultimately required a Republican senator or senators to go to the president to say, you are not going to win this battle in the Senate eventually.
What have Republicans in North Carolina been saying about this, the potential of the president involving himself in this investigation in one way or another, whether it's Richard Burr or Tom Tillis? Or even people at the state level, Loretta?
They don't want him to get, you know, they're saying that they want to keep Mueller in place. They believe that that investigation, as it's going, should continue. We've heard Tillis come out and say that the president should not interfere at all with the Mueller investigation. Richard Burr is very concentrated on his own investigation that is going on, but it makes reference to the fact of the Mueller investigation going on and what is being found there being able to be used by his committee. You're not seeing anybody in Congress saying that they believe that Mueller should be taken away from doing the investigation that he's currently
Liberals
doing.
Have said that they're dismayed by the president not being more outspoken or alarmed by the potential that Russia tried to play a role in the election, whether it was putting out fake news about Hillary Clinton or about Donald Trump, because they did some of that too earlier on, or whether they wanted to have a connection with a political campaign, that the president of the United States, whoever occupies that office, should be outraged by a foreign entity coming in here and trying to influence our political agenda. And he doesn't seem to be that way, and that outrages liberals. Should he be more engaged with this? Even if he's afraid that it's going to touch him, would it benefit him to be more outwardly outraged by the potential of Russian interference?
Yeah, if you're praising or being nonchalant about a foreign power interfering apparently on your side, it leads people to think, well, there's something there that you're cooperating with. So at the very least—
And could he be not— as enthusiastically supportive of these investigations because he's been always very concerned about people viewing his election as being legitimate. And if Russia was involved, perhaps that could remove some of his legitimacy, even if he had nothing to do with it.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think there's a good probability that Russia did what it did for its own reasons, and there wasn't any at least high-level collaboration with the Trump campaign. And that's essentially the story that the Trump team has been giving forth. And if that's the case, I think they have every incentive to demonstrate that that's the case. Right now his attacks on Clinton, you know, are a diversion from the bad news coming out of the Mueller investigation. But I think it's in the president's interest if there is no coordination between his campaign and the Russians to get that all cleared up so he can move on to things that are a higher priority.
And the president has expressed deep disappointment in his Justice Department. And once again, there is the specter of his firing Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, who has recused himself from this so that he can hire a new attorney general who was not involved in any way in the campaign or with Russia, etc., so that they don't have to recuse themselves. What would the impact of that be?
Well, first and foremost, he would have to get a new attorney general approved by the Senate. And even though Jeff Sessions probably does not have a lot of friends right now because of previous statements that he uttered regarding his connections with Russian officials, I think if the president decided to remove Jeff Sessions, he would have a bigger fight with senators on that particular issue, and you know, maybe stuck with his acting attorney general who made the decision to appoint Mueller.
How unusual is all of this?
To have a president going after his own cabinet members?
Yeah.
Unprecedented.
Yeah, I think that's a fair word to say.
How do you explain it? People have said that he wants to be an autocrat and he wants people to step in line because he's a business owner and his company. That's how he runs his company.
Yep.
And this is not
loyalty.
How you run a country. So
it's loyalty to the individual, and it's a very tight circle of folks who are in the know. And I think when a president picks a cabinet, he is diffusing his power to these folks to act on his behalf. And if Donald Trump believes that you're not acting in his best interest, mm-hmm. then you become the target of Twitter tirades.
So let's move this out to more Russian news. It was recently revealed that around 3,000 Russian-connected ads ran on Facebook during the last election cycle. These were seen by vast numbers of people, millions of people, and it encouraged street demonstrations against both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Others of these ads focused support and opposition to Bernie Sanders, to Muslims, to gays, to blacks, and the icons of the civil rights movement. And there were also, of course, fake news stories on Twitter and Facebook from the Russians. Is this a new reality that we're going to have to learn to deal with, or can we get a handle on this? Can we actually stop this if we want to?
Yeah, I think it is the new reality. And the danger for the Republicans and Trump is if they downplay this now, when the Russians decide that the Republicans are the problem,
yeah.
You know, the tables are turned.
Well, some people believe, and some people in Congress believe, that Facebook and Twitter should have their political advertising regulated as it is in the broadcast universe. But in a world where we have PACs and outside interest groups with vague names making accusations against candidates on TV, on radio, in print, in the electronic media, is this really any more egregious? People don't know who Americans for Popular Windows are.
Americans for America.
That's right.
Americans, I mean, how could you be against that?
Exactly right.
But what was shocking to me about these ads is that they were paid for in rubles.
There's a connection.
You don't have to know much about election law to know foreign money is illegal, and if they're paying in rubles, that's not an American dollar. That's an illegal ad.
Wow. And when you have fake news stories being posted and shared on social media, does it really matter what the paid advertising says?
Yeah. Eric made the point about social media and the influence and the continued divisions. I can't see how we corral this into a respectable way of dealing with it.
So then let's talk about taxes. The GOP Sure. tax bill in Washington and the reaction to the GOP tax bill recently unveiled. It would introduce four individual tax brackets at 12, 25, 35, and 39.6%. Corporate taxes would drop. The standard deduction would increase. Child tax credits would expand. Federal deductions for state and local income taxes would go away. The local property tax deductions would stay up to $10,000. The alternative minimum tax would go away. Estate taxes would not be paid on estate values less than $11.2 million, who would be helped or hurt by all of this and more?
Well, the bottom line is that upper income taxpayers are going to get the majority of the benefits because they pay the majority of the taxes. There are lots of tax, or raising the standard deduction is going to help middle income taxpayers, but many of the deductions that they have traditionally relied on are going away too. So it may be a wash for a lot of voters.
Is this tax reform, or is this merely a middle class, an upper class and a corporate tax giveaway?
I'm not a tax expert. Maybe Loretta knows the impact on North Carolina in terms of the tax structure.
Right. I mean, not necessarily the impact on North Carolina, but is it a reform? Yes, it is a reform, but it's a reform that right now people are still trying to figure out who's going to be helped and who's going to be hurt with this reform. It seems as though folks who are on the lower end of the income bracket aren't getting a heck of a lot of help from this. Some people in that middle range will. Obviously, the upper range is going to. The corporate tax rate is coming down, but not coming down as much as President Trump wanted it to come. down. So I think that there's still a lot of questions about this tax reform. They have this plan out there, but it has a long way to go. And we're already hearing that there's, you know, senators who are, if they stick to what they have said in the past, you know, John McCain has said that he wanted it to be a bipartisan plan. Susan Collins had talked about the estate tax, and Senator Corker had talked about he wanted no additional debt in this plan. If those three actually stick to what they said before, this plan isn't going to pass. Yeah.
Well, because these cuts are estimated to cost $1.51 trillion over the next 10 years, and I'm curious to ask, we already have a debt. We have all these Tea Partiers in Congress who got there, including the budget director,
Mick Mulvaney,
who got there because they said we had outrageous debt that needs to stop. This will add to the debt, will it not?
Well, that was Obama's debt. It's totally different.
It's totally different.
Well, they're also saying that this will increase growth from 1% to maybe as high as 5%, and that will take care of the deficit end of this package. Is that true? Does anybody know?
They'll give us lots of estimates on that. In the past, estimates I've seen say you get about 15% more taxes based on economic growth, but that means the 85% is missing.
Yeah.
So I think this is going to be a big challenge for them. That makes it more of a tax cut than tax reform because it's not paid for.
So we don't have time to talk about the impact of the president's recent tweets about people like Bo Bergdahl and the terrorist attack in New York versus what I would call a terrorist attack in Las Vegas. But you can tweet about that on your own time and get it out to the people at large. Dr. Michael Bitzer from Catawba College, Dr. Eric Heberle from UNC Charlotte, and Loretta Beniti, senior political reporter and host of In Focus for Spectrum News. Thank you all for the hour.